Hi, and welcome to New Books in Genocide Studies, part of the New Books Network of podcasts. My name is Kellen McFall from Newman University, and I'm the host of the show. Today, we're going to take a break from my occasional series of podcasts about Rwanda to talk with a returning guest. Samuel Totten is one of the founders of Genocide Studies and the author or editor of dozens of books. He is a professor emeritus from University of Arkansas and now retired, but not quit. He has not yet quit working. Over the past decade, he's devoted an increasing percentage of his time to work in the field. In particular, he's traveled repeatedly to the Sudan and to East Africa more generally to interview survivors and witnesses of the violence there, and eventually to try and deliver humanitarian assistance. Last time he was on the show, we talked about the book he had written about the war in the Nuba Mountains. In addition, we talked at length about the history of genocide studies as a discipline. So I encourage you, if you're interested in that, go to the archives and listen to that if you've not already done so. Now he's recently edited a new account of this conflict. And in some sense, this brings the story up to date. But it's actually a much different kind of book. Sam has persuaded about a dozen people who are working in the Nuba Mountains to write brief accounts of their experiences. The result is an intensely personal look at the conditions in the Nuba and the lives and the decisions of those who try to help the victims there. It's a moving book, simultaneously inspiring and challenging, and I'm eager to talk about it with him. So, with that, Sam, welcome to the show, and thanks for joining us again on New Books in Genocide Studies.
Well, thank you very much for having me. I greatly appreciate it.
So, we talked a little bit last time you were on the show about your own personal background, and we'll touch base a little more about that in a minute. But for those people who are unfamiliar with what's going on now in the Nuba Mountains and in the Sudan more broadly, can you maybe give us a brief sense of the history and dynamics of this conflict?
The Nuba Mountains, which is in the state of South Kordofan in Sudan, was attacked by the government of Sudan in the late 1980s as part of the Second Sudanese Civil War. And the Second Sudanese Civil War was ignited in 1983, actually, and it was a war between the folks in the south and the government in Khartoum. And basically, it was over the fact that the people in the south were almost totally disenfranchised. What I mean by that is they did not have a say in the running of the government. They didn't have representation in the government. They frequently did not vote, could not vote, and as far as infrastructure in the area, they had virtually no roads, none. They had one or two hospitals and a lot of small clinics in an area that was massive, that is massive, and they had few schools, certainly no colleges, and they were being put upon by the government of Sudan. And the Nuba Mountain people became involved in this because the people in the south basically migrated up north somewhat into the Nuba Mountains and fought from that area, and the Nuba ultimately joined in the battle with the south against the north. And what happened to the Nuba was very strange in the sense that they were pretty much cut off from the world, and Khartoum was using food as part and parcel of the war effort, and basically began to strangle almost literally the people of the Nuba Mountains, and then began to both bomb their farms, steal their farms, and the Khartoum began to form these gigantic, what they refer to as mechanical farms, where they brought in, or mechanized farms, where they brought in these huge machines, and the Nuba Mountains became the breadbasket of Sudan at the time. And as the people were being bombed off their farms, they were pretty much pushed up to the mountainside, sheer rock, and had no place to grow food and were fearful of going back down into the valley to their farms. And they began to literally starve to death. And I'm not sure how many people actually ended up starving to death, but they did suffer the entire gamut of hunger. And what I mean by that is not only daily hunger, but malnutrition, severe malnutrition, and then right on to starvation. And so that was that happened between 1989 and the 1990s. And slowly but surely, the international government, international community became involved. And finally, in 2005, something called the Comprehensive Peace Agreement, the CPA, was signed. And as many might know, at that time, it was agreed that, Khartoum agreed that the people of the South would be able to hold a referendum, and the people of the South could vote whether to remain as part of Sudan, part of the nation of Sudan, or leave and form their own nation. And the referendum was held in 2009, and the vote came out to about 99.456 in favor of seceding from Sudan, and they ultimately formed their own nation, the new nation called the Republic of South Sudan. The problem is that the Nuba Mountains ended up being caught in the middle, and they assumed that they were going to go with the South since they fought with the South, but there was some sort of compromise where the Nuba Mountains would remain with Sudan, thus setting the stage, if you will, for the current crisis in the Nuba Mountains. Now, of course, throughout this period, there was the crisis in Darfur as well. And while the international community and most, I think, journalists and activists perceive the crisis beginning in 2003 in Darfur, it actually had been going on for years prior to that, at least back to 1985 when there was a massive drought in the region. And I won't get into a lot of detail, but basically the Arab herders, the nomads, generally would drop down to the farm areas of the sedentary people, the black Africans they refer to themselves as, drop down, ask permission to graze their animals along the farm areas, and generally they would be permitted to do so. However, in the mid-80s, as the drought increased and people became more desperate, both for farmland as well as grazing land, the situation changed in the sense that the nomads became very, very aggressive and quit asking permission, and their animals would come in and eat the black Africans' crops, trample their crops, and so a crisis erupted in the mid-80s, but blew up in 2003 into the war that we now know as the Darfur genocide. The situation in Darfur continues apace. It's almost pure chaos in Darfur. Villages, black African villages, continue to be attacked, not just by the government, but by rebel groups that have splintered off from the main rebel groups. And there's also a lot of criminal activity as well, and gangs that come in and attack people. The government is trying to induce people to return to their villages from the IDP camps. There are approximately 2 million people in IDP camps still in Darfur, and to return from the refugee camps in Chad. There are approximately 600,000 people in the camps in Chad to this day. So the area is still in great upheaval. And then there's another area called the Blue State, Blue Nile State, which is adjacent to the Nuba Mountains, and they're in conflict as well, basically for the same reasons that they're being threatened by Khartoum and are fighting for their own rights.
So the conflict in the Nuba restarted again, what, 5 years ago, 4 years ago? How long has the new iteration of this been going on?
It erupted again in June of 2011. So it's been going on for 6.5, close to 7 years.
And this is a conflict I'm going to guess, unless you're a specialist in the area, nobody has heard about. Why has it been so? Why have journalists not paid attention to the conflict, to this recent conflict, whereas Darfur and other areas have gotten more attention in the past?
Yes, that's a very interesting question. And I would say this, that early on, this is roughly 2011, 2012, even 2013, there was an initial interest in the area. Journalists such as Nicholas Kristof with the New York Times actually made a couple of short trips up into the Nuba Mountains, not too far up, my understanding is, but at least to meet people, to get a sense of what was going on. There were some TV journalists who also made their way up. But as the crisis developed and continued, you're absolutely right, the interest dropped off precipitously. Part of the problem, of course, was that to enter Sudan, one has to cross illegally into Sudan, usually from South Sudan, the Republic of South Sudan. So it's not easy to do. It's dangerous to do, and my sense is that probably created its own barrier. But then, of course, as we all know, crisis seemed to ignite all over Africa, well, large parts of Africa and the Middle East, that I think pretty much drew attention away from this really very tiny crisis in the Nuba Mountains. And so it was probably perceived as largely insignificant, especially when compared to the civil war that we now have in South Sudan, which was ignited in December of 2013.
So what's been the response of the international community to the conflict in the Nuba Mountains? Has there been significant efforts by governments or international organizations to, offer to work to help settle the conflict or to deliver aid? What's been the international community's response?
Primarily, the response has been to carry out diplomatic talks with Khartoum. But these talks, of course, went hand in hand with what was happening as well in Darfur, what was happening in the Blue Nile State, and then the Nuba Mountains. And as I've explained time and time again, is it's been talk, and more talk with very little being accomplished. As far as providing international aid, it's been pretty much nil, with one major exception. And when I say nil, every single organization, NGO or UN organization, pulled out of the Nuba Mountains by, I'd say, probably late 2011, early 2012, And when one travels up into the Nuba Mountains, one sees virtually no organizations, not the UN, not Oxfam, not Doctors Without Borders. No one is up there. No one. And as far as help, I'd say the only major help that the people receive is from the only fully operational hospital in the region, which is run by an American surgeon, an absolutely amazing individual, Dr. Tom Katina. He's a surgeon, and he runs a hospital in the Nuba. And then there's a hospital, but it's not fully operational. That is, they don't perform surgeries. It's called the German Doctors Hospital. And they see a lot of patients on a daily basis. I mean, if you drop by the German Doctors Hospital, there are generally 30, 40, 50 people out in front waiting to be seen by a physician for one illness or another. But as far as food, nothing is happening except for the that is being brought up by individuals in trucks, because planes cannot go in. So the government has pretty much set up a no-fly zone over the Nuba Mountains, so nobody dares fly food in, or not even drops of food, let alone landing. But for the past 6 years, actually, there's been an operation, and it's been actually, we've all been asked, and when I say we, that is the half a dozen or so people who have been trucking food up into the Nuba Mountains during this crisis. We were all pretty much asked to remain silent about a major effort that was underway to provide food. And we all remained silent because the word was out that if anybody mentioned this particular operation, and I will mention it now because other people have mentioned it in print, the expectation was that Khartoum would shut it down. So there was this kind of quid pro quo where the government would allow this food in. And what it involved, basically, is the U.S. government flew in tons of food into South Sudan, the Republic of South Sudan, very close to the border with Sudan, very, very close. And then food was being trucked up by an organization called Samaritan's Purse, evangelical organization that had been very active in the Nuba Mountains for decades, helping to set up water points or boreholes, pumps, and set up schools and churches while they, you know, went about their evangelical work. So that was pretty amazing, and tons of food got in. But everyone else was pretty much on their own, and I may as well mention this now. I mean, the only reason, actually, I even began cooking food up is because I had been informed that there were places that Samaritan's Purse did not go, did not reach, where people were in dire need of food. And part of that was because it was either along the front of the war or very, very difficult places to reach. Otherwise, I would have thought, well, you know, maybe this would have been redundant. And, you know, what's the purpose of risking one's life?
Yeah.
But when I heard that, I decided, all right, there is a reason to go up there and to try to help the people. And actually, some of these other teams that I bumped into were doing the same thing.
So that's maybe a good transition to talk about your own personal relationship with this. And so I'd like to, maybe we could start by asking you to say a little bit about how did you end up, what was the transition point for you from being on a college campus, writing and editing books and giving talks to actually being on the ground in Africa? How did that happen?
Yeah, it was rather remarkable. In 2004, the summer of 2004, I was approached to join something called the Atrocities Documentation Project. And it was a project that was going to involve sending what they referred to as investigators, 24 investigators, to Darfur to collect data from black African citizens whose villages had been attacked, to collect data to basically send it back to the U.S. State Department so that the state could analyze the data to try to ascertain whether genocide had been perpetrated or not. Ultimately, 24 investigators were sent to Chad. It was decided that it was probably too dangerous to go into Darfur at that time, and the State Department did not want to risk, obviously, these individuals from possibly being killed. So what we did is we were assigned in twos, pairs, to different refugee camps up and down the Chad-Darfur border. And so I ended up actually doing that, and I was in a very small village called Gozbeda in southern Chad, and my partner happened to be a lawyer with the U.S. Justice Department on leave, and we were each provided with a interpreter, and we each ended up interviewing approximately, I think, 25 individuals each. Altogether, this 24-member team interviewed close to, I think it was 1,100 individuals. So, and again, as I said, all this information went back to State Department. Ultimately, then Secretary of State Colin Powell analyzed it and declared on, I think it was September 9th, 2004, that that Sudan, Khartoum, had perpetrated genocide and possibly was continuing to do so. That basically ignited my ongoing activity in Africa. What I did on my own was I returned to Chad, I think it was three or four times on my own, and I went back to different refugee camps. And I also returned to Gozbeda. I conducted my own interviews of individuals in regard to what they had experienced during these attacks on their villages. And a long story short, because it is a very long story, but ultimately I ended up with a Fulbright in Rwanda. Huh. In 2009, I was working with the Center for Conflict Management at the National University of Rwanda. I was based in a place called Butare in Rwanda. Since I was there, obviously I had relatively easy travel to get to Chad. So I continued my travels to Chad in between work in Rwanda. And at some point during my Fulbright, I was invited to give a talk at the University of Chicago about Darfur. They were having a conference, and they were bringing in a good number of speakers. I decided to go. And on my way to Chicago from Kigali, we went through, as we always did, Nairobi, and it just so happened that a person sat down next to me who was working in the Nuba Mountains with Samaritan's Purse. I'd never heard of Samaritan's Purse. And so anyways, we traded stories about what we were doing, and I told him I'd been trying to get into Darfur for, by that time, 4 years, and had absolutely no luck. And he said, well, I think I can get you in to the Nuba Mountains. And he told me, I didn't know where the Nuba Mountains were. And he said, The reason that I was attracted to going to the Nuba Mountains is he mentioned that there was an IDP camp of people from Darfur just outside the village that he had been based in. And he said, not only do I think I can get you in there, I can get you a free flight in. And when you get in, you don't need a visa. You just walk off the plane.
Wow.
And I said, I'm definitely interested. And unlike a lot of these situations where people suggest things like this and don't come through, he came through. And probably about a year and a half later, I was in the Nuba Mountains for the first time. And I returned twice in 2010, interviewing folks in this IDP camp, people from Darfur. But then as I learned the stories of what the people in the Nuba Mountains had gone through, I decided to start interviewing them. And then the threat of war broke out in December and January. December 2010, January 2011, while I was there. And then 7 months later, the war broke out.
Huh. So I'm going to guess almost nobody listening to this podcast has ever been to this region. So can you tell us a little bit about what the region looks like and sounds like and feels like?
Sure. Initially, when I went, I flew in. We would land on this field of stone. There was no airport, no customs, as I mentioned. We would land in a retrofitted two-prop plane, and it was half cargo plane, half passenger plane. We would land, we would get off, and we would go into the little village of Kauta, which is one of the bigger villages in the area. And it's very small. The main part of the village is an open air souk, open air marketplace with stands made out of tree branches and, you know, anything they could cover the top with, whether it was, you know, more tree branches or tarps or plastic or whatever. And very dusty, no roads. There were a good amount of green trees and bushes, and it was really quite pleasant. Very rocky, kind of mountainous, and semi-arid as well when you got out into the desert. But it was basically, when you got out in the desert, I mean, it was all scrub brush and brown sand as far as you could see. Huh. And when you traveled on either dirt roads that had been, worn into roads because of constant travel by either people on foot or four-wheel vehicles. I mean, I always traveled in a Land Cruiser when I was traveling long distances, or when I wasn't, I would either hire a motorcycle to drive around on or walk. And when you were off the roads, you were on paths that were thick with sand, and it was hard to ride a motorcycle. And, you know, you kind of, trudge through this dust, and it was very, very dusty. But mountains rose from the valley, and it was very picturesque and quite nice. Now, when I started traveling, though, from the south, once the war began, it was a totally different story, in the sense that when I crossed from South Sudan into Sudan, I would have to drive, and again, I always hired a Land Cruiser from the Nuba Mountains, driven by a Nuba individual, to get up to Kauta. We would go to Kauta and use that as our base camp, basically. And it would take us between 7 and 9 or 10 hours to get there over these dusty roads. A good good part of the way was just basically, you know, that dun-colored sand. And then as you gradually made your way up into the Nuba Mountains, you would pass by these sheer mountains that were honeycombed with caves. And as you drove up, you would periodically come to a roadblock, and the roadblock was comprised of generally sticks in the form of X, or, you know, if it was a little bit more enhanced, it might be something like a gate made out of branches, and you would stop, and there would be rebels there with automatic weapons, and they would come up and ask you or ask the driver initially to see his paperwork, and then he would ask the soldier or the rebel would ask to see everybody else's paperwork. And when we whenever we drove, or I should say whenever we do drive up, we always give people lifts. So we're generally probably carrying up to, you know, 13, 14, 15 people on the back of the truck. And so they check everybody's paperwork. And what I have, of course, I don't have a visa, as I mentioned, but what I do have is a pass from the a group called NRRDO. It's a relief group, but also tied to very closely to the rebel group, the CM People's Liberation Movement / North. But it's rough going. You cross a lot of wadis, dry wadis. Wadi is a riverbed that's bone dry during the dry season and raging torrents of water during the rainy season. And so you cross a lot of wadis. It's always, you know, very rocky going down, very rocky going up, and very, very slow. And periodically, you will come to maybe a place that has four or five trees along the wadi, so it cools down a little bit. But otherwise, the heat is pretty fierce. And I've been up there. I think the hottest it was right around between, I don't know, 112 and 115.
Wow.
And when you carry water, the water turns warm, very warm, very fast, so you don't feel like drinking that. So it's a good slog wherever you go.
So how significant is the suffering in the region now?
Right now, there's a tenuous ceasefire.
Okay.
So at this moment, and the ceasefire has been in effect for the past several months, the good news is the government of Sudan is not carrying out daily aerial attacks. And those aerial attacks were becoming actually more fierce because not only was the were they, meaning Khartoum, carrying out these aerial attacks with Antonovs, and Antonovs are retrofitted cargo planes that Sudan purchased from Ukraine into bombers, but they were also using fighter jets towards the end of this to go in to attack villages. And while the Antonovs were dangerous enough, one always heard them coming because they were lumbering, they were noisy, and so people could always jump into these eight foot or so holes that everybody has done, both in the souks, around the schools, in the people's compounds, in the villages. And so people would jump in these, and when the bombs hit and the shrapnel flew, it would ideally, and pretty much worked quite well, the shrapnel would fly above these holes and not kill the people. But when these fighter jets came into play, it was an entirely different story because they came in so fast and could go solo. It became just that much more dangerous. So now, while people don't have to worry about those aerial attacks, they are still suffering from a lack of food. And the reason being, again, is there are no international aid groups, formal aid groups, that are bringing food up. So it's still being trucked in by whether it's Samaritan's Purse or there's another group called Persecution Project or individuals such as myself. So food is always a problem. The government of Sudan blocks any food that is being transported in to be sold from the north. So they're blocking all food from coming in, and any food that makes it into the souks, the open markets, is sky high. So there are a lot of people who do not have food who are suffering greatly. And, I mean, I could tell a whole slew of stories how that manifests itself today and has actually over the past several years. So that is probably the main pain that the people are experiencing, again, this desperation for food. And while most people in the Nuba Mountains are not literally starving to death, there are pockets of people who are. And I can talk about that as well. And the reason is that they're cut off from the other part of the main part of the Nuba, due to a lot of activity by government of Sudan troops. And so they're virtually an island surrounded either by the government of Sudan troops or the Nile River. And across the Nile River, you've got South Sudan and the treacherous situation over there. So people are suffering from, let's say, daily hunger. Most people are going without three meals. A lot of people are going without two meals. And there are people who are suffering, and this has been documented from most people are probably suffering from malnutrition, but not severe malnutrition or starvation, though numbers certainly are higher for severe malnutrition.
So the essay you write includes kind of a very personal narrative about your experience delivering food there. And I'm wondering what your wife thinks about what you do.
Yeah, that's a very complicated situation. My wife, who is also now a retired professor, she was in the Department of Nursing for 30-plus years at the University of Arkansas at Fayetteville. I think one of the things that initially intrigued her was the fact that I never stopped talking about genocide. It must have been a very strange relationship early on, now that I look back at it. She became well aware early on that really my passion was this issue of genocide. And she actually told me prior to my departure for work with the Atrocities Documentation Project, she said, this is going to be a sea change in your life. And, you know, I kind of listened to that, but I was more geared up to getting over there and getting to work and didn't really reflect on that. But she was absolutely right. Because, as I mentioned, as soon as I was done with that, I ended up going back to Chad, and now I've been to the Nuba, I think, five times during the war, two times prior to that. And she doesn't like it.
Yeah.
And that's due to, I mean, first of all, of course, there's the fear that she knows, you know, quite well that these bombings took place. And at one point in time, I had been serving as a relay. I was receiving photographs of the initial attacks, and I mean the photos are gruesome. I mean, it looked like people had gone through, had been chopped up by meat cleavers, or grinded up in food manufacturing operation, and so she was very fearful about that. In fact, the first trip I took into the war zone, I entered on Christmas Day. And so I wanted to, I always carry a sat phone, a satellite phone. And so Christmas Eve, I called her to wish her Merry Christmas, and she wouldn't talk. Because she was afraid that, it was common knowledge that the government of Sudan could hone in on these satellite phones, or for that matter, any sort of technology, and, send planes in if they wish. So she wouldn't talk. Yeah, she's well aware of the danger. And, of course, I would come back with, these stories about running out into the desert or dropping into these holes when the Antonovs came over, which didn't help the situation, obviously, as far as her, her concern obviously sure. rose with each and every trip. And then I ended up becoming very dehydrated, and that's another story, but long story short, I ended up in a Doctors Without Borders field hospital for a week, and then I was medevaced out to Nairobi Hospital, where I ended up there for a week, and then she became even more concerned not only are we facing the bombs now, but there's this dehydration problem, which could be very serious. I ended up hitting my head against a cinder block wall in a makeshift shower in a refugee camp. So while she's worried, she's been incredibly supportive. As far as I'm concerned, I've got the best wife in the world. I mean, she supports everything that I do. It really does not complain. I mean, she'll complain early on when I say, well, I'm getting ready to go again. And she keeps saying, well, you keep saying that, you're thinking about, not going as many times. When are you going to make the final decision? But other than that, she is as supportive could be. Which I think is very unusual.
No, your essay is in here, but the book compiles, I don't know, a dozen or so?
Right, 13, I think, yes.
Yeah, how difficult was it for you to persuade people to write about their experiences?
Not very difficult, actually.
Good.
There were a couple of people. I did have to kind of, metaphorically speaking, twist their arm. And I had to go back to them probably three or four or five times. And by the time I went back to them, I started to use the fact that, seven or eight folks and have decided that they thought, think this is worthwhile, and I would mention their names and the work that they did, and that would draw new people into the project. But once I landed a person named, and I've mentioned him, Tom Katina. Everybody knows Tom Katina. When I say everybody, I mean everybody in the Nuba Mountains knows this guy, and they refer to him as Dr. Tom. And anybody and everybody who goes up into the Nuba to try to help the Nuba, they all know Tom. They've all met him one time or another, if not worked with him for months. And so when they heard that Tom Katina was part of this and was sharing his story, there was a lot of avid interest in taking part.
So as I was reading these, one of the things that I thought was important about these was the ability through these personal narratives to get a sense of why people make a decision to get involved in this very personal way. So what is your sense from these essays? What motivates the people you ask to contribute to participate? Not participate in the book, but participate in helping the people of the Nuba.
Yeah, well, actually, I think There are several, different motivations, but interestingly, a lot of the folks are motivated, a lot of the folks I've met are motivated by the fact that they're Christians. Yeah. And they feel that they have a responsibility to reach out and help others. And I'm not just speaking about the evangelicals. I mean, obviously the evangelicals have a purpose in mind when they were up in the Nuba Mountains, and that was to, convert people to Christianity. So that was one thing. But the people who are evangelicals, they're not up there solely trying to convert people. They're up there to help people as well. And I mentioned the fact that they would put in these, dig these wells and put in hand pumps. They would build schools as well as churches. And they would help to fund medical clinics. So they did a lot of good for the people, in a secular fashion, that the people were grateful for, because it is, and I hate using this word, but I'll use it since a close friend of mine who is a Nuba uses it. It's pretty primitive in the sense, not the people. The people were quite sophisticated, I think, but primitive in the sense of living conditions. Mm-hmm. And so if you get a place where you can pump water, I mean, it saves people literally hours from walking to a fetid pond where they load up their buckets of water and then have to carry it miles and miles and miles. So it really does radically change their lifestyle. So that's one case. But there are also Christians who are not evangelicals necessarily who are up there, and most of these individuals are attached to Mother of Mercy Hospital, the major hospital, and they go up out of the goodness of their hearts, as well as, of course, their Christianity, reaching out and helping others and showing love to others. And so there are a good number of people who do that. But then I've also met individuals who are not necessarily up there for reasons of their Christianity, but are doctors who have an expertise, and for years they've reached out to other groups around the world, whether it's in South America or Alaska or Asia, and have heard about the situation and have gone up and served as surgeons or assistant surgeons or whatever. And then there are reporters that end up going up there and staying for good periods of time, who work on different projects, and either initially covering what's going on, but then getting to know the people and becoming more involved with projects, such as one individual who was in the book, his name's Tomo Krisnar, who actually went up and started setting up ways to document attacks on villages. Another reporter went up and joined what is called Nuba Reports to help cover the attacks, and then to disseminate these reports to media across the globe. And then there are individuals like myself who are pretty much unattached had the initial interest in what was happening from a academic point of view, that moved in then to, I guess you could say, social activism, who befriended a lot of Nuba who were concerned about the actions of the government of Sudan, and decided, well, these people need help, so help them.
Yeah, so you use a really interesting phrase in your introduction. You say that these stories say much about what it means not to be a bystander. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, I mean actually a lot by that. I mean, number one, you know, as an educator for years and years and years, you know, I've come across the concept of bystander, you know, initially with the Holocaust and what it meant, people basically standing rather aloof, either watching up close what was happening to the Jews and others, or outside the region and hearing about what was going on, but remaining silent, not doing anything to try to activate interest in or concern about what was happening in Nazi Germany or, you know, the occupied territory. But then, of course, when I started looking at other genocides, it was rather obvious that bystanders were a common factor in relation to all genocides. That is, either there were people on the ground who didn't do anything, didn't say anything, didn't try to help those who were in desperate need, and even more outside the region, who basically went about their lives, maybe read about genocidal actions, and did absolutely nothing, said nothing, really didn't care about it any more than maybe a you know, a huge car accident or something. I mean, it caught their attention and they went on with their lives. But very few people I've found are willing to take a stand, and not only take a stand, but take a stand within a region where the killing is taking place. And I don't know if most of these people went in to the Nuba thinking, well, I'm not going to be a bystander. But ultimately, what they did was absolutely contrary to being a bystander. That is, they went in, they witnessed what was happening, and they reached out to try to help those people who were in desperate need in one way or another. And so they were no longer bystanders. And what really surprised me was that not only were they not bystanders once, these people kept going back. And you would think, you know, some of them actually were perceived by loved ones and friends, and I include myself in this category, as nuts, crazy. There was something wrong with you for doing that. In fact, I'll tell you, and I won't mention the person who said this because I'm now on good terms with him again, and I don't want to get crosswise, but a very, and if he listens to this, he'll know who he is, of course, a very well-known scholar of genocide studies, told me that I had something like a messiah complex going in. And we got into a little verbal exchange about that. And, you know, he really made me start to ruminate about that. And actually, I went to Dr. Israel Sharni, noted scholar of genocide studies, who happens to be a psychologist and psychiatrist. And I asked him, I said, do you think I'm just suffering from something like this? And he gave me, you know, his professional opinion and said, no, I don't think so, but I think there are other things at work. So anyhow, yeah, these people are standing up and speaking out. And when they get back, they speak out as well. And they help get the word out. And they some of them have gone up to Capitol Hill and testified. So these people are definitely not bystanders. I mean, they are activists, and they're working to help these folks in any way they possibly can.
So you went from scholarship to activism, and I know that's a false polarity, but what has your experience being an activist taught you about studying genocide?
Well, it's very interesting because the reception to such has been extremely mixed. I've had scholars basically state unequivocally that you can't be a scholar and an activist.
Huh.
You're one or the other. And that if you're an activist, then it pretty much calls into question any academic scholarly work that you do on that same topic. So in other words, if one is conducting research in the Nuba Mountains on the current crisis, but one becomes an activist, then they purport that everything that one writes, no matter how analytical, no matter how well it's documented with empirical evidence, is automatically called into question. So there's that. And then there are others. And again, we're talking about genocide scholars who are... who are complementary, let's put it that way, for lack of a better term, who convey their respect for what, you know, what one is doing, what I was doing, what I am doing, and at the same time say, well, you know, it's not something that I would ever do, not because of the activist part, but simply because it's kind of beyond their ken, if you will. And then there are others, and some fall in this the category that I just mentioned, who are incredibly supportive and write and ask me, how can I support your efforts? And a lot of these folks, genocide scholars, have actually donated funds to help me purchase food. And what I've made very clear to everyone, and this is just an aside, is that I do not use any funds that I receive from anybody for my travel, for hiring a driver or a vehicle or for food or whatever. It's all for my own food, I mean. It's all to purchase food to deliver to the people. And there are a good number of genocide scholars who have supported all five trips that I've made up in the Nuba Mountains during this war. So that's rather remarkable.
Yeah.
And then I should say that there are also, though this is rather limited, there are also a core group that are interested in having me, you know, write up and explain what I'm doing and why and how, and publishing those results. And then, of course, yourself, this interview. So,
yeah.
You know, it really runs the entire gamut.
So we're starting to run out of time. So I'm wondering, you said, I think the phrase you used was tenuous ceasefire. What do you
Yes.
see as likely in the near future for the Nuba?
I think there, it's my gut feeling that this ceasefire is going to be broken.
Yeah.
Now, it has held for a good number of months. But there are a number of factors that come into play. First of all, there's now, for the first time, fissures in within the Sudan People's Liberation Movement North, which is the group from the Nuba Mountains, and one. Part of the group wants to continue the fight. Another wants to sign the peace agreement and go back to a footing where there's, you know, obviously no more war. But the group that wants to continue fighting says we are never going to receive our rights if we capitulate, and this is the way they put it, capitulate to a peace agreement, because we're going to be back to where we were after the Comprehensive Peace Agreement was signed in 2005, where we're under the thumb, the fist, of President Omar al-Bashir, the president of Sudan, and the government of Sudan. So there's that problem. There's a lot of distrust, as you can imagine, between Khartoum and the rebel group. And my sense is that sooner or later, the fighting is going to break out again. How long it's going to last, I do not know. But one of the things that I was told over and over and over again during all five trips by members of the rebel group, including officers, is that the plan was to go all the way to Khartoum. And what they meant by that is we're going to overthrow the al-Bashir regime and we're going to take over and, you know, we're going to make form new Sudan. So I don't think that mentality is left. That mentality is still there. And I'm not putting it all on the rebels because the threats are still coming from Khartoum as well. I mean, periodically, what you hear from Khartoum is, well, hey, we're going to establish Sharia law all over that country. And even the Muslims, the moderate Muslims in the Nuba and Darfur, don't want any part of that. So there's my point is tension is still there. And I'm not sure exactly how that tension is going to be resolved or dissolved for that matter.
Well, I thank you so much for your time. It's an important story. And an interesting one that you're telling. I always ask the kind of the final, same final question for listeners who want to know more. Can you suggest something that our listeners, or maybe me, the semester's early, I have in theory a weekend where I don't have anything to do, no grading. What can we read or maybe watch to learn more about the conflicts that you're observing and working in?
You actually have a couple of books. I mean, one is somewhat technical and really very limited in its focus, but for me it was rather enlightening. And because what it talks about is actually a international operation that tried to get food into the southern parts of Sudan during the war, that is the Second Sudanese Civil War, which, as I mentioned, involved the Nuba. And it's got a rather long title, but it's called Humanitarianism Under Siege. The subtitle is A Critical Review of Operation Lifeline Sudan. Huh. And it's by somebody that I think a lot of folks who have studied humanitarianism will know, Larry Manier. It was put out by the Red Sea Press in Trenton, New Jersey. And it talks about why this, how this was launched, why it was launched, who was involved, basically it was a relief effort to help stave off, the disaster of starvation. The interesting thing, though, is that this lifeline never made it into the Nuba Mountains. Now, another book that I would recommend, which really has to do with Darfur, but it's a fine read, and actually this individual made a stand as well, which really intrigues me. It's by a person named Mukesh Kapila. Kapila, who has become a friend, and the name of the book is called Against a Tide of Evil. And the subtitle is How One Man Became the Whistleblower to the First Mass Murder of the 21st Century. A rather remarkable book. And I would say those two, off the top of my head, are something that people, you know, might want to sure, to read, referred to.
Excellent. Well, I know you're planning on another trip soon, and so I wish you safe travels and we will be thinking of you. And I thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you very much. I really greatly appreciate the opportunity. So all the best to you as well.
All right. Thank you much. Take care. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to an interview with Samuel Totten about his new book, Sudan's Nuba Mountains People Under Siege. As you heard in the interview, Sam is planning more trips to the region. If you'd like to learn more about his efforts, I've posted contact information on the website for this podcast. You can find that page through the webpage for New Books Network. If you enjoyed this interview, you can listen to previous podcasts through iTunes or Stitcher or from other podcast providers, or again from the webpage for New Books in Genocide Studies, part of the New Books Network of podcasts. I hope you'll join me next time when I talk with Omer Bartov about his new book, Anatomy of a Genocide. Until then, thanks for the download and have a great month.